This is WSBT's Community Update on 96.1 WSBT.
Good morning, I'm John Hoffman. A look first at the state of play this past week with the coronavirus in St. Joseph County. Deputy Health Officer Dr. Mark Fox spoke with WSBT 22's Bob Montgomery on First in the Morning on Monday.
ICU capacity, we're in good shape. Our number of people hospitalized has increased, you know, this week over last week, but still okay countywide in terms of hospital capacity. The most striking thing, if you look at the state chart, you see the numbers. Our own numbers here in the county, this is the first time that we've had 3 days with more than 30 cases just back to back. We've had other times where we've had more cases, but never more than three consistently for a 3 day period. So our number of active cases right now, our estimate is there are about 330 active cases of coronavirus in St. Joseph County.
Is that based on test results coming back in, or is it based on actual new cases that are exploding in essence?
These are new cases diagnosed in the last 2 weeks. So we look at we have a couple different metrics we look at. We look at the average number of cases per day over a seven-day trend, because we have lower testing over the weekend, so that means Tuesday, Wednesday, we generally have fewer test results with that time delay. So we look over a 7 day period to kind of flatten that out and get a better sense of what's happened. And then because the active incubation period is 2 weeks and we think that people can be shedding virus for, you know, essentially that period of time, we look at the number of new cases diagnosed in a 2 week period and consider those the most active cases.
We've heard of a number of people who are getting tested, and it, of course the delay is back up just because of the sheer numbers of people getting tested right now, and they're turning to some of these quick tests and they're not always as accurate. Do you recommend people getting those quick tests?
You know, for people who are symptomatic, the rapid test is probably okay. And I know, you know, obviously the hospital emergency rooms have access to the rapid test. A number of the urgent cares around town have access to it. So it's probably reliable enough in people who are symptomatic. And if it's positive, then we ought to presume that they're positive. Not nearly as reliable for people that are asymptomatic, so we can get some wonky results there.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about education. There's been so much talk over the last week or so, and it will continue, about getting kids back into the classroom. It's the political side, but there's also the medical side. You have mentioned your family in the past, so I'm going to ask you, you have school-aged children. Are you comfortable sending your kids back to school?
Our plan at this point is to send them back, both for the education, but everything else that goes with that, the socialization and other opportunities we think are important. And they're better realized with live instruction, probably in most cases, than with virtual instruction. But that's still predicated on a lot of things: the ability to maintain physical distance in the classroom, really the insistence on universal masking. I've seen some of the statements from the school saying you have to carry a mask with you at all times. Yeah, you probably need to wear a mask at all times.
Except they're talking about physical distancing. Anytime you have to wear a mask, anytime you can't physical distance. Is that not far enough?
Probably not, because it's not only proximity, it's the duration of exposure, and this supports the idea that there is at least some airborne transmission. But if we spend 8 hours together in a classroom, we might be this far apart. But if we're breathing the same air all day long, there probably is some risk there that isn't fully accounted for and we don't honestly completely understand.
The New York Times is out this morning talking about a report from the CDC. It got some internal documentation, says there are some people within the CDC who are concerned that if the kids go back, that presents the highest risk. And on the one hand, you would think, well, that makes sense. There's more of a risk being in school versus being at home. Is it as simple as that, or does it go beyond that?
It probably goes beyond that, because there's a difference for elementary age kids compared to high school kids. So for reasons we don't fully understand, we know that younger people are less likely to have severe complications and death, although they certainly can occur in pediatric populations. But for some reason, elementary school age kids don't transmit the virus as effectively as high school kids. So a high school student who's infected is more likely to infect other people than an elementary school kid, which is kind of counterintuitive. You'd think the elementary school kid is not going to pay attention to physical distance and mask wearing, but there's a suggestion that they transmit less effectively. So there may be a rationale for saying elementary school ought to be treated differently than high school.
Yeah. So wanted to ask you about protocol. If a child gets comes down with the coronavirus, or a teacher, or whatever the case may be, in a business, for example, oftentimes a production assembly line would be closed down, or if it's a small enough business, a business would close for quarantining purposes. Are you recommending that for students as well? If a classroom has suddenly an active case, that everyone in that classroom quarantines for 14 days?
Well, it all depends on the definition of a prolonged close contact. And so with physical distancing parameters and universal masking, there really should be no one that qualifies as a prolonged close contact. That would be the goal, both at the university level, we're working hard with the area institutions, to try to create an environment where no one meets that definition of a close contact. Our goal is to do the same with the K-12 schools as well. So that means it would just be attention to regular sanitation protocols and symptom monitoring, things like that, but wouldn't have to shut down the classroom or the building or send everyone to quarantine.
So ultimately where we stand today as we wrap up, we are in a fairly decent place hospitalization-wise. We're in a good place ICU capacity-wise, but you are starting to see cases
trend
ramp
is
up.
Going the wrong way.
It's going
absolutely
the wrong way.
Got my attention and very concerned, and it's not where we want to be as we contemplate bringing university and K-12 students back to the classroom. You know, if we want to be at our lowest point to bring those groups back into the classroom setting.
Dr. Mark Fox of the St. Joseph County Health Department on WSBT 22's First in the Morning. The lease for a COVID quarantine site at a Motel 6 on 933 in Roseland was originally set to expire back in June, but was renewed until July 15th.
Ever since April, this site has been used to house the homeless who have either been tested for coronavirus or waiting out the virus. Dr. Mark Fox, who's the deputy health officer for St. Joseph County, says the last person admitted to this coronavirus isolation center was on July 5th.
We always felt like that facility was larger than we expected to need. We thought that, you know, our projections, had things been bad in the homeless shelters here locally, our projections were that we might need 40 to 50 beds.
The motel rented out its 82 rooms to the local task force for about 3 months for $270,000. Fox says it ended up serving a total of 84 people. The city hired round-the-clock security, bedbug exterminators, and a cleaning service that cleaned to hospital grade when guests left.
It wasn't that the town wasn't for it, it's that we were never notified.
The president of the Roseland Town Council says the council would have required the motel to have a medical license. But South Bend Mayor James Mueller told our partners at the South Bend Tribune the motel operator was the only one willing to partner, and there was no time for discussions with Roseland officials. The town did pass a new ordinance requiring future isolation centers to have a medical license.
No one else can come in here and just commandeer a motel or a hotel now for a COVID center. You will fall under medical, which is a different licensing.
McComb says for Motel 6 to open again as a coronavirus isolation center, it would have to go to the town council first. Dr. Fox says the county needs to find another place to house homeless coronavirus patients. Fox says that he is still working on that plan to find a new isolation center. Meanwhile, the director of communications for the mayor's office actually just reached out to me and said that he has worked with the Roseland Town Council and he appreciates them for being constructive and making sure that this site has filled the critical need.
WSBT 22's Bree Isom reporting. South Bend administrators, teachers, and parents are all trying to work out what a fall semester may look like. The teachers' union says it's concerned with a physical return to school in August.
NEA says people will die as a result, but teachers will do their jobs because closed schools provide greater societal challenges. The superintendent and two school board members say the options provide flexibility, not only for teachers, but families too.
Superintendent Todd Cummings says he's grateful for the feedback of the NEA. He acknowledges some vulnerable teachers may hesitate wanting to come back to school in person.
Teachers are going to be able to volunteer, and they're also going to be asked for doctor's notes. So we make sure that the folks who are teaching virtually really are the folks that we need to work with their doctors to make sure they can teach.
School Board Vice President Leslie Wesley appreciates the options.
I'm glad that Dr. Cummings came up with three different models. So those teachers that are not comfortable, we want to make sure that they are comfortable and maybe teaching in a different type of model. Because we really value our staff.
Yeah. What's the next sound you need?
School is scheduled to start August 12th. Cummings wants as much feedback from everyone involved with the schools to determine what will happen.
What we want to do now is we want to ask the community, what does that start day look like? Does it start face-to-face? Does it start virtually? Does it start a couple days a week?
Wesley says the in-person option exists for a reason.
We just need to let everybody understand we have to follow the federal guidelines of what they say about reopening. And so we're hoping that we have some creativity in being able to accommodate probably not all, but a vast majority of our families here in South Bend.
School board member Stuart Green says it's a pretty well thought out set of options. He says some families with working parents, for example, would like to see school open, but there are others who have valid concerns about the health of their children.
We're not trying to decide for parents what they should do. We're not trying to decide that we can provide a safer environment than home life can. We're just saying we're trying to be responsive to all the different opinions, you know, that we're receiving.
The teachers union says it's committed to working with the school board, city council, and mayor to safely reopen schools. The district is hosting forums in person and virtually, and the school board has a working meeting open to the public on Monday. The board is expected to vote on specifics of the plan August 3rd.
WSBT 22's Caroline Torrey reporting. Imagine your kids attend a local public school district and 30 minutes down the road, kids get almost three times the funding per student. That's the reality in Berrien County and across much of the country. The nonprofit education research group eBuild has a new report looking at the most recent census data.
Studies show that students from low-income backgrounds like those in Benton Harbor need about 25% more money per student. If they get that, they can achieve like their peers from wealthier backgrounds. But the opposite is happening right now in Berrien County. Here's the basic problem. Benton Harbor schools get about $10,000 per student between local property taxes and state dollars. 30 minutes down I-94, students in the same county going to New Buffalo schools get $27,000 per student, mostly from local property taxes. Benton Harbor superintendent oversees a district with 45% of students living at or below the poverty line.
What do you think you could do as a superintendent with $27,000 per student?
We could build a rocket ship and go to the moon.
According to a new EdBuild report called Clean Slate, these huge disparities are common across the country. But that doesn't mean we should accept them.
94.
Zahava Stadler is the managing director of the nonprofit education research group. She says the thinking for these wealthier school districts is simple.
We're going to keep our home values high and needy kids out and our school budgets big.
She says those with the most don't want to share with those who have the least, or even those with less. And because of the way school district borders function, they don't have to.
When you draw a school district border, you do two things. You say, this is the area that kids are going to come from for these schools, but also this is the set of properties from which we're going to raise money for these schools.
She says district borders are one of the most powerful things we have to define which kids get access to which school resources.
Okay, cool.
Berrien County has 15 public school districts, but some benefit from their property taxes in a way that leave the rest of the districts in the dust. Take another district in the county that's benefiting from the current system, Bridgman Schools.
Bridgman is raising a huge, huge amount in local dollars. They're raising close to $14,000 per pupil just from local sources.
On top of that $14,000 per student in property taxes, Bridgman Schools get about $1,400 per student from the state. Benton Harbor Schools get $3,600 from local property taxes and $6,600 from the state because of the high number of students living at or below poverty. That $6,600 is the state's attempt to make up the difference between Benton Harbor and nearby districts like Bridgman and New Buffalo. But it's not nearly enough.
They're getting more from their local revenue than Benton Harbor has all told, state and local, all in.
And you can add River Valley schools to that list as well.
All told, River Valley has over $5,500 per student more than Benton Harbor.
I asked Representative Aaron Miller, the chair of the state legislature's school aid subcommittee, about the funding system that's in place across the state. He didn't hesitate.
It's not fair. It's not right.
But here's another key point. Benton Harbor isn't the only district getting shortchanged in the current system. 11 other county districts also get nowhere near the amount of money per student as New Buffalo, River Valley, and Bridgman.
There is a huge group of losers out there in the current system, and there's a very small group of winners.
WSBT 22's Tolly Taylor reporting. New Buffalo schools did not respond to requests for comment.
The views expressed on WSBT's Community Update are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, WSBT Radio, its staff, or management. Join us again next week on Community Update on The Sports Leader, 96.1 WSBT.